Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Bronx House Dawn from the Boogie Down Bronx, and you're now listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
There were bells on the hill, but I never heard them ringing. No, I never heard them at all, till there was you.
James Gavin is the biographer of some of the most acclaimed jazz musicians of the 20th century, including Chet Baker and singer Lena Horne. Both of those artists had pretty strange lives, but Gavin actually saves that word, strange, for his latest book, an exhaustive account of the life of Peggy Lee. It's called Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee. And to give us a look at Peggy Lee's strange life and beautiful music, James Gavin once again joins us on Soundcheck.
It's great to be back, John. Thank you.
So, you know, I use the word exhaustive. I was exhausted at times reading Peggy Lee's life. It is strange. Why did you use that word in the subtitle?
Peggy Lee lived in a dream world. She created her own reality in order to escape terrible conditions that she was growing up in and anything else that seemed distasteful to her. As I was writing this book, I realized that Peggy Lee's bio, as she told it, was largely a myth. And in fact, it was largely a myth drawn along the lines of Cinderella. It included an evil, brutally
an evil stepmother.
Violent stepmother. It included a Prince Charming named Dave Barber, mm-hmm. who was the love of her life.
The first of her four husbands.
Indeed. And left her in the early 50s. And if someone successfully lives in a dream world, life is very happy. If you pull it off 100%, there's nothing to be upset about. Most of the time, you do not. And that's the monster that nips at your heels throughout life and drives you to do things to try and blot out the truth. The remarkable thing about Peggy as an artist is that when you saw her perform, you sensed all this turbulence behind a very placid mask. Mm. And
so she had that Scandinavian, upper Midwest kind of cool to her.
She did. She came out of a hard scrabble, post-prairie North Dakota life where life was tough and there was no point in complaining about things. So you stoically went about your day. And yet that doesn't mean that you weren't volcanic inside. Mm. And that volcanic quality behind the mask to me is what makes Peggy Lee's work so compelling.
So she starts, you know, singing in her town there in North Dakota, gets a gig at a radio station, moves to, I mean, there's this like incremental step-by-step progression to suddenly being discovered by Benny Goodman. And so it seems like a meteoric rise. It's all happening while she's still a teenager, but it is an exhausting journey. And much of the book revolves around Peggy Lee being on the brink of exhaustion all the time.
She was. That's true. Man, it was a hard road to success. And then maintaining that success was a constant struggle, especially around the time, I'm speaking now of 1969, when Peggy's thriving fame at Capitol Records after 20-some-odd years had dimmed and Capitol was on the verge of dumping her. Mm. Meanwhile, Peggy had found this song called Is That All There Is by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller that was an odd, surreal monologue that questioned the whole meaning of life. And she felt that this song was her salvation. And she insisted on recording it, and she had to maneuver in very wily ways to get Capitol to release it at all, and that became the title song of my book.
Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is. And when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth.
There were clowns and elephants and dancing bears, and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is?
Is That All There Is? The name of the song from Peggy Lee, and the book is called Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee, brand new from James Gavin, who most recently on Soundcheck was here talking about, James, your book about Lena Horne. Peggy Lee, like Lena Horne, was someone who, in her own way, was kind of racially ambiguous. Very early on, people sort of noted that this white, you know, Norwegian girl from North Dakota sang black. She said she sang black.
Yes, in the 1940s, Peggy Lee's Capitol singles were being sold in Harlem record stores amid records by Duke Ellington. Count Basie, for example, whom she discovered on shortwave radio in her little train depot home in North Dakota in the mid-30s. And Peggy Lee was galvanized by the feeling in between the lines of that exciting bluesy swing of Count Basie. She identified with it because she felt that she identified deeply with black struggle, black pain. And as the years went on, Duke Ellington and Basie and Ray Charles and all of those great masters felt that she was right. They heard that authentic sound of the blues in her voice.
When you go to an early hit of hers, like Why Don't You Do Right, I mean, there is that kind of bluesy quality to the voice there.
In spite of the fact that she was an alabaster-skinned, very fair, blonde, Scandinavian girl, it was unmistakable. And that sound in the universe of swing-era singers who were usually girls next door, who sang on the beat, who had a very quote-unquote white, clean sound— there was Peggy with just enough of a dash of something else to really make her stand out.
We're talking with James Gavin about his brand new book, Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee. It's kind of a strange story to how this actually got released in the first place. There was a looming musician strike because they were going on strike to protest not getting royalties from broadcasts like this.
Benny Goodman was known among musicians as being quite sadistic. Whether or not he intended it that way, I don't know. But he tortured a lot of musicians and kept them constantly terrified of what he really thought of them, how good he thought they were. And so it was with Peggy Lee. But when she heard this song, she felt this connection with a song by Lil Green, a Chicago blues singer and pianist.
If you had prepared 20 years ago, you wouldn't have been drifting from do to do. Why don't you do right like some other men do?
She felt that she had to sing it, and Benny let her sing it. He had it arranged for her. She recorded it, and then he kept her waiting and waiting and waiting, and she doubted that it would ever come out. Only because, probably, of a recording strike that was imminent and Columbia Records' need to put out anything else that was remaining on the shelves did Why Don't You Do Right come out. And that's the song that's the reason why we're here today.
You had a plenty money, 1922. You let other women make a fool of you. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money, too. You're sitting down wondering what it's all about. You ain't got no money, they will put you out. Why don't you do right like some other men do? Get out of here and get me some money too. If you had prepared 20 years ago, you wouldn't be a wonder now from door to door. Why don't you do right like some other men do?
That is Peggy Lee with her 1942 hit, Why Don't You Do Right? And she sings, I mean, we talked about the bluesy quality. There's a saucy quality to the voice as well. But it's the quote-unquote softly with feeling thing that becomes, this is the iconic sound of Peggy Lee. How does that develop?
I think it came very naturally to her because, as I said, she grew up in an atmosphere of people with hard lives where complaining was ill-mannered and pointless. And so she developed this reserve about her very naturally. And I think that although she had much more lung power than people know her for, Peggy was going to keep a lid on it almost no matter what. And it was revolutionary almost. Bing Crosby had been doing something similar to that prior to Peggy Lee.
Right.
But Bing is, to me, more or less what you see is what you get. It's not that Bing didn't have a lot of dark shadows in his psyche as well, but Peggy had this air of, yes, strangeness, mystery about her that you couldn't quite identify when you heard her sing, but there was just something askew about Peggy Lee when you saw her up there that set the imagination awhirl. Very much like Chet Baker, whom I've written about before.
Right. Now, you know, we can't talk about Peggy Lee without hearing Is That All There Is and Why Don't You Do Right? And, of course, the Siamese Cat song from Disney's Lady and the Tramp. But Don't Smoke in Bed, a 1947 song by Peggy Lee. You say this song is kind of a watershed moment for her, or a turning point.
That recording is very film noir, in my opinion. Very dark, very full of mystery. Here again, Capitol Records was stockpiling sides before a recording strike. And so they grabbed at anything that they could get. And Don't Smoke in Bed was a very terse goodbye message from a woman who is leaving her man, who leaves a goodbye note that explains very little, and she's out the door. And Peggy Lee heard this, and she got goosebumps. And this really was the beginning of the mystery lady as we knew her, who developed in the 1950s.
When she would become a major part of the American cultural landscape. But there were inklings, there were rumblings on the horizon in 1947, including this song called Don't Smoke in Bed.
I'm packing you in. Like I said, take care of everything. I'm leaving my wedding ring. Don't look for me. I'll get ahead. Remember, darling, don't smoke in bed.
A torchy number from Peggy Lee, Don't Smoke in Bed, 1947 song, and as author James Gavin told us, kind of a turning point in her career, the beginning of that mysterious Peggy Lee sound. James's new book is called Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee, and she did have, as we head through the 50s, a major career in music and a minor but important career in film as well.
Yes, she did two movies for Warners, one of them not very good. I think most people would agree that the remake of The Jazz Singer with Danny Thomas is a rather pale film. She was stuck into that film as a replacement for Doris Day, mm-hmm. who had pulled out at the last minute. Okay, shelve that one and fast forward to Pete Kelly's Blues of 1955, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award, playing a speakeasy age, New Orleans, 1920s, Gunmal, who was also a singer and who was deadly depressed and alcoholic, not so far from the real-life Peggy Lee. Many people observed her in that film and said that she was more or less playing herself, but boy, did she play herself in that film. And she has an asylum scene in which she has gone insane. Jack Webb, director, star, producer, was there to...
The Dragnet, Jack Webb.
Bingo, yes, Joe Friday, to glean some information from her, trying to dredge a clue out of her insane mind. It was a powerful performance.
Yeah. And she seems not to have recovered readily from not winning the Oscar. You know, getting the nomination was not enough for Peggy Lee.
She wanted more. Now, this was 1955. The golden age of the movie musical was over. I don't know what Peggy Lee would have done in Hollywood at that point, but the truth is that Peggy Lee, as was revealed when she did a couple of dramatic parts on TV later, had one great performance in her. And that was the one that you saw in Pete Kelly's Blues, but she was also drinking a lot.
Well, now, I have to beg to differ, because I think she is tremendous in The Lady and the Tramp, the Disney film.
Oh, but she wasn't on screen.
I know.
But thank
you
for bringing it up. She played four character voices in Lady and the Tramp and wrote all the original songs with Sonny Burke.
I was surprised to learn in your book that she actually did all the recording for this 1955 movie in 1952.
I think she signed to do the film in 1952, and I believe the recording sessions were a bit later than that, but they were certainly prior to 55.
So it was a long kind of gestation for this.
It was indeed, and that contract that she signed in 1952 bore great import decades later, when one word in that contract, namely transcriptions, enabled Peggy to win a long court battle against Disney for unpaid royalty.
So as you say, she does four characters in Lady and the Tramp, co-writes the songs. There is this little clause in the contract, because she's under contract to Capitol, that says that Disney doesn't own the rights to, among other things, transcriptions of the songs. So when we get 25 years later to the world of VHS tapes and things like that, suddenly there's this huge pot of money. And here's this little clause that allows Peggy Lee to get in there and get her share of it.
She was mad as hell, especially because Disney was trotting her out before the public and to the Disney castle, putting her on TV shows to promote this and giving her stingy honorariums. And that is what set Peggy off. She sent her secretary at that time to the file cabinets. She had the original contract. She pulled it out. Very few lawyers were willing to consider going up against Disney. But a lawyer named David Blassband did it. He took on that case, and although it was costly and debilitating, Peggy Lee was absolutely determined to win this David and Goliath battle.
And to the tune of over $2 million, she did win.
She got her pot of gold and set a precedent in the business.
Yeah. And, boy, she is, you know, just one of the integral parts of the sonic fabric of that great animated film, Lady and the Tramp, and most especially for this song, where we get not one but two Peggy Lees, the Siamese Cat song from Lady and the Tramp.
We are Siamese, if you please. We are Siamese, if you don't please. Now we're looking over our new domicile. If we like, we stay for maybe quite a while. Do you see that thing swimming round and round? Yes. Maybe we could reach in and make it drown. If we sneak up upon it carefully, there will be a head for you, a tail for me.
Siamese Cat song from Walt Disney's animated feature, Lady and the Tramp, from 1955. Peggy Lee doing both vocals there. She co-wrote the songs, voiced several of the characters. There is a great scene, James Gavin, in your book where Disney's animators are trying to get the correct kind of sachet for the cat who is the lady of the night. And, you know, they go out to the bars and the clubs and they just can't find anybody who's really into it. And who comes in to give them the right moves?
Peggy Lee. She was a can-do gal, and she had always in her career a very clear artistic vision of how she wanted things to go, and her instincts were really fabulous.
Yeah. The 50s were an exhausting time for her, but they were a time of great success. And then as the 50s turn into the 60s and rock and roll kind of pushes big band music off to the side, she needs to recoup and kind of, you know, figure out, regroup and figure out what she's going to do next. And this is when we eventually, this is that late 50s point where she hits another high note with Fever. Tell us that.
She had in her genes, but certainly in her training, the blues, and the blues being the seed of rock and roll as well. She was able to make that transition very well. Fever was a modest to middling R&B hit at that time for Little Willie John, and co-written by the great Otis Blackwell. And her bassist, Max Bennett, brought her that record. She was looking for new love songs, but this was not the kind of love song she was looking for. Once again, she heard it, and she just knew, Peggy Lee knew, when she could pull it off. But what Peggy Lee did was she took two existing versions, Little Willie's and one by a white guy named Ray Peterson, and she plucked elements out of each of them that she thought would work, but the minimalism of that recording, the bass, the hints of percussion, the finger snaps, those were Peggy Lee's ideas. And to this day, we can't really hear Fever without hearing her version in our heads.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, a fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daytime, moon lights up the night. Light up when you call my name, and you know I'm gonna treat you right. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight, fever in the morning, a fever all through the night. Everybody's got the fever, that is something you all know. Fever isn't such a new thing, fever started long ago.
Fever from Peggy Lee, late 50s, and boy, the sound is so dramatically sparse and minimalist, to use your word, James.
Peggy had inside her, as I've been saying, this turbulence that she didn't give specific voice to, but it permeated. It just swarmed around all the notes and all the phrases. That's why Peggy knew that silence was very powerful. Silence isn't powerful if there's nothing coming through. But when you feel that vibration in the air inside that silence, then that is the key to what makes Peggy Lee exciting.
Now, her turbulence took many forms. You've mentioned, you know, drinking and prescription drugs. Her weight was a constant battle. Illness, both real and imagined. I mean, the psychosomatic stuff begins very early in the story of Peggy Lee. And, you know, it at some point it becomes difficult to kind of figure out which is real and which is not.
John, the lunacy of this story kept me amused from the beginning to end. Peggy Lee, at her most tragic, also had a great comic element. And reading my book again and again in the editing stages, I found myself laughing a lot because it's just so whacked out. This story is off the wall. She was no Billie Holiday in terms of being you know, identified historically as a tragic figure.
Right.
I cannot think of Peggy Lee as a tragic figure. I think of her as triumphant. Happiness was hard to come by for Peggy Lee, but she had a fabulous sense of humor. And when we think of her, or when I envision Peggy, I see the little smirk and I see the sexy glint in the eye and I see the outstretched hand snapping during fever. I think most people would probably agree.
The story of Peggy Lee's life is told by James Gavin in the new book called Is That All There Is? It is appropriately subtitled The Strange Life of Peggy Lee. He's been with us here in the Soundcheck studio. James, thanks so much.
Love being with you, John.
I'm feeling mighty lonesome. Haven't slept a wink. I walk the floor and watch the door. And in between I drink black coffee. Love's a hand-me-down broom. I'll never know a Sunday in this weekday room. I'm talking to the shadows, 1 o'clock till four. And Lord, how slow the moments go when all I do is pour black coffee. Since the blues caught my eye, I'm hanging out on Monday, my Sunday dreams too dry. Now man is born to go a-loving. A woman's born to weep and fret. Stay at home and tend her oven and drown her past regrets in coffee and cigarettes. I'm mooning all the morning, morning all the night, and in between it's nicotine and not much heart to fight. Black coffee, feeling low as the ground. It's driving me crazy, this waiting for my baby to maybe come around.
That does it for this podcast, but make sure to check out our archives of live performances, in-studio videos, exclusive music previews, and much more at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. See you next time.